This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
Kind of liking this jazzy music. I feel like I should be sitting here playing the drums to it or something. Your thoughts in the comment section, Substack, and YouTube as we get into day 7 of the trial that is supposedly going to tell us whether or not Keefe D is officially the man or one of the men behind the murder of Tupac Shakur. In day 7, Malcolm Greenridge took the stand. He was court-ordered to be there. He didn't volunteer, and he told the jury that Tupac Shakur was his childhood friend, his big brother, his mentor. He rode to Las Vegas with Tupac and his fiance. Oh. Did you know Tupac had a fiance? Yeah. Kadeah Jones for the Mike Tyson fight. He was in the car behind the BMW when shots hit it on the Las Vegas Boulevard. The prosecutor asked Greenridge where the shots came from. From inside the vehicle, Greenridge said. The back seat. The answer matters because the prosecution alleges Dwayne Keefe D. Davis was in the front. And in the world, the prosecution spent day 7 building for the jury. The front seat is where the orders came from. Greenridge is also known as Edie I Mean, a rapper and producer, founding member of the Outlaws, the group that recorded an album with Tupac and was featured on many of Tupac's tracks. He is prosecution witness number 19 and the first person from Tupac's inner circle to take the stand. Every witness from Tupac's world has been compelled to appear. People closest to the murder don't want to participate in the case built around it. Greenridge rode to Vegas for the Tyson fight in a Lexus with Tupac and Jones, Quincy Jones's daughter, by the way. He didn't go to the actual fight. He waited for Tupac's call and never got it. He was in a car behind the BMW on Las Vegas Boulevard when a white Cadillac pulled up alongside it. He told the jury he saw the shooter's arm but could not see the faces of the people inside. He could not identify anyone in the vehicle. When he was able to reach Tupac, he yelled at him to get on the ground. They're coming. Gonna shoot you. When he turned around, a police officer had a shotgun pointed at his face. He gave a statement to the police that night. After the shooting testimony, Greenridge told the jury that Tupac was building when he died. Tupac was starting his own record label. He wanted to release the Outlaws album distributed through Death Row Records. He was in talks with Quincy Jones, his fiance's father, to do business together. Tupac was only 25 years old. He had a label, an album, and a meeting with one of the most powerful men in the music industry. The man in the front seat of the white Cadillac allegedly ended all of it. A juror asked Greenridge one question. Were shots ever fired from your crew towards the attackers? His answer, no. The shooting on September 7th, 1996 was one directional. Shots from the Cadillac into the BMW. Tupac's side did not ever fire back. In the afternoon, the prosecution called Robert Ladd. Ladd is a former Compton Police Department gang detective who spent years working the Southside Compton Crips as part of the department's two-man gang unit. He and his partner carefully tracked the gang's membership, operations, and internal hierarchy until Ladd retired in 2014. He has said publicly that he and his partner tried to tell investigators who was responsible for the shooting decades ago. Ladd testified he was familiar with Davis in the 95-96 timeframe. He told the jury Davis was ranked as high as you can get in the Southside Compton Crips. He identified Davis as a shot caller, the person in the gang hierarchy who decides what happens and who does it. A shot caller doesn't carry the gun. He doesn't fire a shot. He gives the order. That's the distinction the prosecution has been building towards for 7 days. And Ladd is the witness who explained it to the jury in plain language. Ladd was asked about Orlando Anderson. The nephew Davis had described in recordings as his best friend, his everything. Ladd said he'd made contact with Anderson many, many times over the years. He testified that he witnessed what was essentially Andre's gang initiation. Gunfire erupted so close to Ladd and his partner that they barely survived it. They later learned the shooting was part of the initiation process. Anderson became a full member of the Southside Compton Crips. He was shot and killed in an unrelated gang shooting in May of 98 at the age of 23. All three other men who were allegedly in the white Cadillac that night are dead. Anderson is dead. DeAndre Smith, who prosecutors allege was in the back seat with Anderson, is dead. Terrence Brown, allegedly in the driver's seat, also dead. Hey, kids, what's a great industry to get into? Gangbanging. Yeah, it works out well. Everybody ends up dead. Davis is the only person from the car still alive 30 years later. His own words, recorded across multiple formats over nearly two decades, are the prosecution's entire case. There is no other surviving witness from inside the Cadillac to contradict him, and no other surviving witness to confirm it either. The prosecution has to build its case from what Davis chose to say and from experts like Ladd, who can tell the jury that those words and what they mean inside the gang's hierarchy. Ladd then discussed how gang culture operates at its core. Members live for respect, he testified. The prosecution asked what a member would do if he felt disrespected. That question carries context, the jury has heard all week. Prosecutors allege the shooting was retaliation for the brawl at the MGM Grand, where Tupac and his entourage jumped Anderson hours before the murder. The brawl was captured on security camera footage the jury has already seen, and you probably have too, in the last 30 years. Anderson was beaten on the casino floor by multiple members of Tupac's entourage. According to the prosecution's theory, Davis, the highest-ranking Southside Crip in the group, decided that the beating could not go unanswered. The Cadillac, the gun, the drive down Las Vegas Boulevard followed from that decision. Ladd also addressed his own department's history. He insisted that the Compton Police Department's dissolution was not due to police corruption, getting ahead of any defense attack on his credibility before it arrived. The prosecution's purpose with Ladd is to connect the hierarchy to the charge. Greenidge said, the shots came from the back seat. Ladd told the jury the man in the front seat was the highest ranking member of the gang. Together, those two facts draw the picture. The shot caller handed the gun back and let someone else fire it. Day 7 was the day the prosecution connected the front seat to the charge. Davis's own words have been playing on tape for a week. The 2008 proffer, the 2009 interview, the Death Row Chronicles recordings, the book, those words established what happened in the Cadillac. Greenidge established where the shots came from. Ladd established what it means to be the man in the front who doesn't fire. In the hierarchy of the Southside Compton Crips, according to Ladd's testimony, the shot caller is more responsible than the shooter. Without the order, the trigger never gets pulled. The prosecution isn't charging Davis with being in the car. They're charging him with being the reason the car was there. The fiction defense now has to contend with more than Davis's own statements. It has to connect and contend with a former gang detective who has no stake in the documentary, no book deal, and no camera crew. Ladd says Davis's position in the gang meant that if he was in that Cadillac, he was directing the operation. That isn't something Davis told an interviewer. That's something the hierarchy tells you. Between Greenidge and Ladd, the prosecution ran three witnesses through the evidence from the September 23 search of Davis's Henderson home, crime scene analysts Jeffrey Scott and Stevie Feliba. Documented the scene. Detective Justine Gastis testified about the items impounded. The jury saw photos of Davis's copy of Compton Street Legend, his own book about the shooting. They saw newspaper clippings about the 96 murder recovered from his home, articles mentioning Orlando Anderson, articles mentioning Biggie Smalls. sorted in bins for decades. A juror asked Scott, what piece of evidence were you expecting to find in a location that was different from 30 years ago? Scott said he wasn't expecting to find anything specific. He was just there to document whatever the detectives pointed to. The answer the prosecution couldn't get in that moment. The evidence survived because the shot caller kept it. He published the book. He saved the clippings. The man Ladd identified as the highest ranking member of the crew built a personal archive of the murder he allegedly ordered. Greenidge didn't want to be there. He told the jury what Tupac was planning at 25, the label, the album, the business with Quincy Jones, and he told them the shots came from the back seat. Couldn't name the shooter. Couldn't identify anyone in the car, but could tell them where the gun was pointed from. That was enough. Ladd told them who was in the front, the clippings in the Henderson house, told them the rest.
It's looking a little damning.
It's looking a little damning for Keefe D. You know, if he didn't write the book, if none of this would have happened if he didn't write the book, didn't do all the interviews, he wouldn't be on trial right now. Because quite honestly, I think if you just brought him to trial without all of that, I don't know that you'd have enough to convict. You wouldn't have enough to get to trial, quite honestly. At the end of the day, his own words, Keefe D's words, are what is going to matter more than any witness willing or unwilling to take this stand. Will they be enough to convict him? Will his own words be the nail in his own coffin? What do you think? Tell me in the comment section. Substack and YouTube. Take the podcast with you wherever you are going. There's the QR code right there. Scan it. And then there you go. We're with you on your device, on whatever podcast player you prefer. Apple Podcasts, Spotify. We are there. Join us. Shall you? Until next time. My name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi.
The last thing the prosecution played for the jury was a phone call from the Clark County Detention Center. Dwayne Keefe D. Davis, on a recorded line, said, I have blood on my money. That sounds like it would have been a good rap song back in the day, doesn't it? Blood on my money. Could you just almost hear it? You know, maybe I'll make it with AI. And then the prosecution rested. 25 witnesses, 8 days, roughly 8 hours of recordings from 4 separate sessions where Davis described his role in the murder of Tupac Shakur. The final thing the state wanted the jury to carry into the break was a man on a monitored phone saying his money has blood on it. Every inmate in Clark County knows the calls are recorded. Davis said it anyway. Day 8 opened with 2 defense objections to clips the prosecution planned to play. Both were addressed outside the jury's presence. Both were apparently overruled. The clips made it to the jury. The prosecution called its 25th and final witness, Adam Stoher, an electronic evidence specialist from the Clark County District Attorney's Office. Stoher's job was technical. He authenticated and clipped the audio and video the state wanted the jury to hear on its last day. The first clip showed Davis in an interview discussing his book, Compton Street Legend. He was asked a question and said he didn't want to talk about it. A second clip addressed his career. And the prosecution played a YouTube video of Davis holding up his book and encouraging viewers to buy it. His pitch to the camera, buy this to get the real truth. The defense's theory is that the book was fiction. Just all invented for money. The prosecution's exhibit is the author on camera selling it as truth. The next clip set up the motive. Davis on camera said Tupac was in the wrong when he jumped his nephew Orlando Anderson at the MGM Grand on September 7th, 1996. He called Anderson a kid. He said his nephew never jumped on Tupac, that the attack was unprovoked. Prosecutors alleged the shooting hours later was retaliation for that brawl. Davis was telling the camera his side had a reason to act. Star was also played a clip of Reggie Wright Jr. from earlier in the trial. Wright, a former head of security for Death Row Records, had testified about the events of that night. His testimony established the relationship between the Death Row camp and the Southside Compton Crips, the world where these two groups collided. And the prosecution shifted to the evidence that closed the case, the jail calls, multiple recordings from the Clark County Detention Center made after Davis' arrest in September of 2023. Every call from Clark County is recorded. A warning plays at the start of each one, telling the inmate the conversation is being monitored and may be used in court proceedings. Davis had been in custody for nearly 3 years. He has heard that warning thousands of times. He's really good at not eating them. In one call, Davis complained about his case. "They're trying to use my words against me," he told the person on the other end. He said he should have stopped doing interviews. Shoulda, woulda, Keefe. It's Davis acknowledging from a jail phone that his recordings are the prosecution's entire case. He knows the proffer was a mistake. He knows the documentary and the book gave the state everything it needed, came from his own mouth, and he's a little frustrated about it. In separate jailhouse interviews with a local television station, Davis went further. He claimed he was never in Las Vegas the night Tupac was shot. He said he wasn't there, no car, nothing. That claim contradicts every recording the jury has ever heard, including the 2008 proffer where Davis placed himself at the front passenger seat of the white Cadillac and described providing the gun to his nephew in the back seat. Kind of not there. In another jail call from the same facility on the same kind of recorded line, "I have blood on my money." Huh? Two calls from the same building. In one, Davis says the case against him is unfair, and the other, he tells someone his money has blood on it. The prosecution played them for the jury and let the contradiction just kind of simmer. Just sit in that room. You guys decide what this all means. A man performing fiction for paychecks doesn't call someone from a detention center and say his money is blood on it. That sentence doesn't generate royalties. It doesn't land a deal. It's a man who knows where the money came from and what it cost and is speaking aloud and then maybe taking a step back and going, "Oh, shit, that's on tape." The prosecution's final exhibit is Davis saying the quiet part on a recorded line. He can't take it back. It is there. Staff had no questions on cross-examination. The jurors had no questions. Stewart left the stand. The prosecution rested. The state's case is now on the record, and its architecture is visible. They built from the outside in over 8 days. Week one, the crime scene, the timeline, the officers who responded, the surveillance footage from the MGM Grand, then the recorded chain, the 2008 proffer where Davis told LAPD detectives he provided the gun, the 2009 Las Vegas Metro interview, the 2017 Death Row Chronicles recording, the BET documentary clips, then the human cost. Greenwich, Tupac's childhood friend, court ordered to testify about the shooting and the plans Tupac never finished. Then the hierarchy. Ladd, the Compton gang detective, telling the jury the man in the front seat was the shot caller. And finally, the jail calls, the version Davis didn't mean to tell. The prosecution sequenced the man's own voice, destroying his own defense, format by format. Each layer stripped away one more explanation the fiction defense could offer. The proffer could be blamed on the federal drug charges Davis was facing at the time. He was looking at a potential life sentence, and talking was his only way out. The documentary could be blamed on money. The book could be blamed on ego or bravado. The YouTube clips where Davis promoted the book as the real truth could be blamed on salesmanship. But the jail call? The jail call has no explanation inside the fiction theory. A call made on a recorded line in a building he can't leave to someone who wasn't paying him. That's the one version of the story where money, fame, and performance aren't available as explanations. The prosecution called 25 witnesses across 8 days. They had no murder weapon, no DNA from Davis at the scene, no fingerprints, no phone records from 96, no surviving witnesses from inside the Cadillac who would testify against Davis. What they had was a defendant who spent nearly 2 decades telling anyone who would listen that he was in the car, that he provided the gun, and that his nephew fired the shots. And on the last day, they had a jail call where he said the money from all that talking has blood on it. It's also an interesting look at a case being tried in the past to a certain extent. I mean, there are elements to this that are of today, of YouTube clips and such. But I mean, that could be just as well a documentary. The platform to which it appears on is not necessarily unique to the time. I mean, the platform is, but the method, the on video, is not unique to our current time of 2026. This is a case that doesn't have cell phone evidence because there wasn't cell phones. Think of that for a second, kids. I mean, did cell phones exist at the time? Yes. Were they commonplace in 1996 for everybody to have them? No, not at all. Maybe, I would imagine there was probably a handful of people in the crew that probably had a phone. Maybe. A car phone, most likely. Meaning like it's physically attached to the car. In 1996, the idea of this was science fucking fiction. So all of our GPS trackers, all that stuff, did not exist. So all these things that we rely on in newer cases, more modern cases, as to basically giving away and telling you, here's what happened. This is a case that's being tried in a different place and time before we had all of those markers that can really tell on someone the way that they can. And is asking a jury 30 years after the fact, without any of those tools, to say, did you do it? And sometimes the biggest damn thing that gets someone caught for their crime is not the digital evidence. It's not the cell phone pinging. It's not the Google search. It's not any of these things that just did not exist in 1996. Google did not exist in 1996. It wasn't a thing. Neither were iPhones. Neither were any of it. I don't even know. I don't think flip phones were. There wasn't a flip phone yet. That's how, this is a different place. Without any of that, the man's mouth is what is likely going to be the thing that gets him locked away, the ego one. As I always say, narcissism always wins. Not the narcissist, the narcissism, the look at me, the grandiosity, and this is a grandiose narcissist. This is someone, in my opinion, I can't diagnose him, but this is likely, I mean, he wrote a fucking book about being the Compton Street legend. This is his own words describing himself. I think it's safe to make an assumption the man might have some narcissistic tendencies. Bragging about what a horrific human being he's been as a gangsta, as a Compton Street legend. Openly talking about murder and thinking, what could possibly go wrong? Narcissism wins. We'll find out. We'll find out what the jury thinks at the end of the day. Three of the prosecution's witnesses, James McDonald, Devonta Lee, and Malcolm Greenwich, had to be court ordered to testify. 30 years after the shooting, the people closest to this case do not want to participate. the code of the streets has held for them. Attorney Michael Snapp has characterized his client's statements as fabricated bravado. He's accused investigators of failing to independently verify Davis's account. He's right about the corroboration. The prosecution has almost no physical evidence tying Davis to the weapon or the scene. The defense's job is to convince the jury that everyone and that every recording was fiction, coercion, or performance. That's their task. Now, as the stage is there, Snapp told the judge he has a detective and two police officers lined up to testify. Pre-trial reporting indicated the defense also planned to call a false confessions expert. That witness has not yet been confirmed in the courtroom. Closing arguments are actually stated for Monday. So we're expecting a very short defense window here. Basically, today, tomorrow, Monday closing. Davis has the right to testify. He's going to have to make his decision pretty quick. The man who told the story, the detectives, documentary crews, a book publisher, and cameras across multiple productions, now has one question in front of him. Does he tell it one more time under oath with the prosecution holding every version he's already given? If Davis takes the stand, the prosecution gets to cross-examine him. They can play his own recordings and ask him to explain the contradictions, the proffer where he placed himself in the car versus the jailhouse interview where he said he was never in Las Vegas, the documentary where he promoted his book as the real truth versus the defense's argument that the book was fiction, the jail call where he said his money, his blood on it versus his claim that everything was made up for a paycheck. If he doesn't take the stand, the jury decides without hearing him directly. The last thing they heard from Davis was a jail phone call. The defense gets its witness, a detective and two officers, and then closing arguments. The trial that took 30 years to reach a courtroom may reach a verdict here within 2 weeks of testimony. Every word Davis has spoken about the Tupac shooting is now evidence. The last four the prosecution played were, "I have blood on my money." The jury now decides what that means. What do you think it means? To me, this is a man that's flailing. I think we all know he was there. He's going to try and lie his way out of it. He appears to be doing that, attempting to, and not doing a great job. Call me crazy. But can they convict beyond a reasonable doubt 30 years later without all the evidence that we rely on in a modern day case? What do you think? Your thoughts in the comments section. Substack, YouTube. Be sure to join us. Be sure to take the podcast with you. QR code is right there. Scan it with your phone. Choose your platform, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, whatever. And there you go. Press subscribe. Should not miss any of our coverage. Until next time, my name's Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.